This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an airline captain who flies the Boeing 737-800 and the 737 MAX 8. You'll learn a lot from someone who has hands-on experience with these aircraft. We also bring you an interview with the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. The role the union plays in areas that affect the flying public is impressive. In the news, we look at the nominee to be the next FAA administrator, private pilots providing services to disaster victims, and the decision to replace aging F-15s with the F-15X. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 545 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year, and he knows just about everything there is to know about the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
And Max, I'm going to be seeing you next week at Sun and Fun in Florida. It should be fun.
That's right. I haven't seen you in, what's it been, about 5 years or so?
More than that. It was when AOPA was in Hartford, which would have been, gosh, what, 2010 maybe?
Hard to believe. All right, yeah, it'll be good to see. Will I recognize you?
Yeah, I'll be the handsome Max.
No. Okay, no, probably. Also joining us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hey, guys. I'm looking forward to tonight. We'll max out the conversation, I'm sure.
Yes, you bet. Also joining us this episode is Rob Mark, senior editor of Flying Magazine, publisher of the Jetwine blog, and past Airplane Geeks co-host. Rob, it is so good to have you back.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you talking to me?
Pay attention.
Oh, yeah. Pay attention. Hey, it's nice to be here for the night.
All right. Also with us is our main man, Micah. Boy, we've got a full house. Hey, Micah.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. So great to be here from a almost springtime Maine.
Yeah, you guys lag about, 3 months behind the rest of the world when it comes to spring. Maybe not that much, but
pretty close. We're getting into mud season now.
Yeah, fun. Oh, joy. Our guest this episode is Jeff Felmuth, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force, retired. Jeff is a captain on the 737, both the Dash 800 and the MAX 8. He has over 16,000 hours of flight time, including more than 12,000 civilian hours. Now, besides the 737, Jeff has time in the A300, the Boeing 767, 57, and 27, as well as the Saab 340 and the Seminole. In the Air Force, Jeff flew almost everything. Jeff flew the F-16D, the F-15A through E, as well as the T-41, T-37, T-38, and the OV-10A. Jeff, what a spectacular career. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's quite an honor to be here. I didn't think this would ever happen because of Monday schedules for me, but I'm glad to be here.
We're so glad to have you. We're going to have some great conversations coming up. I'll note earlier today, Rob and I spoke with Sarah Nelson. She's the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. And Rob, I thought it was a very interesting conversation.
I did too, actually, because we talked about a great many topics, least of which actually was the 737 MAX grounding. We discussed quite a few labor issues from the last few years and decades past, and where she sees the future as headed for labor.
Yeah, I was really surprised to gain an understanding of how many important issues the union was involved in a positive way. So we'll have that coming up. Looking forward to that. Also coming up this episode, we'll talk about the 737 MAX with Jeff. But first, we have other news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready in the North.
I'm ready from David's hometown.
Ready.
All Our first story comes from AOPA. Former Delta executive nominated to head FAA. Now, the White House has nominated Steve Dixon to be the new FAA administrator. You may recall that when Michael Huerta retired from the FAA, Dan Elwell took the role of acting administrator, and he's held that position for about 14 months. Well, Dixon is from Delta. He retired from Delta just recently in October 2018 after a 27-year career. He was most recently senior vice president of global flight operations. The aviation press, at least that I have seen, seems to think fairly highly of Dixon.
The guys I know over there at Delta who knew him and knew his work are glad that he's there. They think it's going to be a good fit.
Certainly AOPA's President Mark Baker is enthusiastic. In fact, he says Steve Dixon is a solid choice to lead the FAA. The two of them worked together on the Next Gen Advisory Committee. And Dixon, he's been an outspoken opponent of ATC privatization, which is probably why Mark Baker, or one of the reasons why Mark Baker is enthusiastic about him. Dixon has called ATC privatization reckless, and that it would disrupt the progress of next-gen implementation.
It's kind of interesting. Delta actually did a flip-flop. So for years, they were the only major that was opposed to privatization. But then toward the end, they kind of jumped on board. So I don't know what his involvement may or may not have been. But it was interesting that they did that flip-flop. It's good to see that we've got someone with executive experience with, you know, 47,000 employees to manage. And I just looked at the breakout. There are about 4,000 in Washington, and there are 37,000 at various regional field offices. So the FAA is really scattered, over a lot of different facilities. So it's good that they've got someone with executive experience.
I wonder, too, though, that because the position was vacant for, 14, 15 months, I wonder how much of this 737 issue kind of pressured the White House to kind of finalize that decision.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure why it took the White House as long as it has.
Well, they don't have much of a record for getting people confirmed in the sort of the outlying cabinet positions. I mean, Supreme Court, yes, and in fact, even the defense secretary is only a temp.
So this is a 5-year position. The administrator position is 5 years. And everybody seems to think that this is a good choice. We'll see how it goes. Next up, this is from CNN. Private pilots are giving free flights to stranded residents in a flooded Nebraska town. Well, recently we've seen a number of natural disasters that have resulted in deaths and property destruction. Certainly we've had that cyclone in Africa that's killed hundreds of people, and flooding in the Midwest United States has devastated many communities. In general, aviation responds in times like these in many ways. And in this article, CNN is telling the story of a GA pilot named Adam Liston, who was actually himself evacuated as a result of the flooding. And when he and his wife went back, Mandy, they said they knew they had to help others. And so they've been helping fly people in and out of Fremont, Nebraska, which at the time anyway was otherwise cut off. We see these kinds of, you know, great things that that pilots do, that general aviation does in the course of these natural disasters. It's a good time to sort of spread the word as to the value of general aviation in the community.
You know, GA pilots kind of remind me in some ways of ham radio operators, because in the event of a natural disaster, in the event of something going wrong, they're right there to help and pitch in and do what they need to do. And we see the volunteerism that takes place with GA pilots with some of the angel flights that we've talked about on the show, and we see it here, and it just sort of reminds me of the community that's built among GA pilots. All that, that hangar talk when we go to EAA meetups or Sun and Fun or Oshkosh or whatever it happens to be, it comes together as a community. And I think it's a very, it's a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, the other common thread between the hams and the GA pilots is that they don't rely on some of the standard infrastructure. So if all the cell phones are knocked out, hey, hams are still able to get up and running. Likewise with pilots, if you've got major airports that are shut down, hey, they can still operate from small airports.
Good point, Max.
Here, Listen and his wife, Adam and his wife, Mandy, they started a crowdfunding campaign. Because, you know, when you have pilots volunteering to move people, move supplies, things like that. I mean, in some cases, they're, you know, renting an airplane. There's the fuel costs and all. So, I mean, this is not an inexpensive thing to do. They're volunteering their time, but they have a lot of expenses associated with it.
Yeah, no question. Fuel does not come cheap. And so that's probably the big thing that they're using the money to offset. Yeah, this one I thought was interesting because it was more of transporting people from what I was reading than transporting supplies. Most of the GA relief efforts I can remember were more involved with transferring supplies. So I do see in this particular picture, they do show boxes being moved from the airplane. And you can't identify many of the boxes except for one. And you can tell it's mission critical. It says Bud Light on the side of it.
Oh, no.
But, you know, based on what you were saying before, Max, and Rob and Max West can talk more about this than I can, but based on the licensing, they can't take any cash. That crowdfunding is very important. They can't be paid for this. They can only have some sort of expenses supported, and it must be a very difficult situation.
Well, especially if they're flying a lot. You mentioned the Angel flights, and we see people at transport animals during natural disasters and supplies. It does get pricey. But as you said, they can't take money for any of that. And it's out of the goodness, the kindness of their heart. These people usually love flying anyway, but it doesn't hurt that somebody's, you know, covering the fuel.
I still remember when we had the Loma Prieta earthquake out here in the San Francisco area over 25 years ago, and the only way to get into the town of Watsonville was via the airport. And so we had planes flying in and out constantly. It's a small airport, probably 4,500-foot runway, and it was just GA aircraft bringing in supplies nonstop. At one point, they organized a flight of, I believe it was something like 75 aircraft, and they put together a special ATC procedures, and this conga line of 75 airplanes flew down the bay, you know, at 90 miles an hour, all following each other, and all landed down there. So it was a major relief effort.
In this case, this pilot says that he started at 8 a.m. on a Sunday, running purely on generous donations. He says, but by noon, dozens more pilots and planes showed up, eager to help. He said it was a full community effort. That's great. All right. Moving to military. Now, we talked about the F-15X before, and David sort of explained it, I guess, but I don't know. It didn't completely sink in. So we'll talk about it again, I guess. This is from defensenews.com. Industrial base considerations played role in F-15X decision. So the Air Force's F-15 Cs and Ds are getting old, and the Air Force had to decide what planes to purchase to replace them. Now, let me ask a question, and I think I know what the answer is, but I'll ask it anyway. Why don't old F-15s last as long as B-52s, which seem to last forever?
A lot of it has to do with how many Gs you're putting on an airplane at metal fatigue. Every time you do an air-to-air sortie, you're putting 9 Gs on the airplane several times, and that's a lot of fatigue on the airframe. And even in the Strike Eagle, you know, you're doing a low level at, you know, 500 feet and 500 knots. That's a lot of bouncing around. So it's a lot different than just flying a B-52 straight and level. I mean, yes, they do low levels. They don't do that anymore, I don't think. I know they stopped them for a while because it was too much stress on the wings. But it's just fatigue. You had that one fault break in half out there in Missouri, I think, several years ago, where it broke right behind the cockpit. I know they did a Golden Eagle program right before I retired, where they literally looked at every F-15 that was still flying and went back to the very first entry in the logbook and did an entire history review on every airplane to to see which ones they were going to keep.
Well, the replacement decision is maybe more complicated than you might think on first blush, right? There's, you know, what airplane fills the role the best? What about production ability, acquisition costs? What about support maintenance infrastructure and support costs? So the Pentagon's Cost Assessment and Program Evaluation Office, that's CAPE, C-A-P-E, they favored a fourth-generation aircraft, and apparently the Air Force and former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis agreed with that, but what plane? And a senior defense official said the question then was, how are we going to maintain a robust industrial base? So as a result, the Air Force requested these eight F-15Xs in the fiscal 2020 budget. But it's a little more complicated because Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan was employed by Boeing for 30 years before he became the Deputy Secretary of Defense in 2017. And the Defense Department's Inspector General has announced that Shanahan is under investigation for allegations, right, just allegations, that he showed favoritism towards Boeing. So in his defense, Shanahan says that he recused himself from all decisions involving Boeing, which I would hope he would, because that would at least give the appearance of being a conflict of interest.
I was going to ask, Jeff, since you've flown pretty much all the F-15s, can you tell us what the mission roles of the C and the D are and where the X might be coming into play?
Okay, well, the B and the D are just what we called them family models. They were the two-seaters that every squadron had one or two of those. So a B model is just a C model, an A model with an extra seat, and a D model is a C model with an extra seat. The difference between an A and a C is 2,000 pounds more internal fuel and upgraded avionics and a stronger wing. The A models were slightly more G-limited, especially initially, than the Cs were never G-loaded, G-restricted at all. They were straight up 9 Gs right out of the chute. And the C was a lot better avionics. The E model was the air-to-ground version, and it was the Cadillac of the fleet. It was completely glass cockpit. It had a better air-to-air radar than some of the C models did. Some of them had much bigger engines. They had the 229s that would actually super cruise, not like the F-22 does, but it would just, in mil power, it would break the Mach, which was kind of impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was the avionics that really differentiated the three different aircraft. Now, the interesting thing is on the X, they're reinstating two stations. And I was, you know, when I first got in the airplane, the first station you ever talked about was 2, and the last one was 8. Well, what happened to 1 and 9? And they're actually further out on the wing, not on the wingtips. They're about 3 feet in. And never found it. I mean, you could see where the plugs were, where you could put a pylon there, but we never used them. When you put a pylon out there, you turn that thing into being able to hold a boatload of missiles. You figure you can put 3 on each pylon easily. And if you had like a bomb rack kind of thing, like you can put 6 Mark 82s on under each wing of a Strike Eagle without even thinking about it. So you could put 6 AMRAAMs on each of those pylons if you configured it correctly. It'd be a lot of drag, but the airplane has more than enough power to deal with it. One of the limitations of the F-22 is that he's only carrying 4 to 6 missiles.
Hmm.
So when they went out the red flag for the first time in the F-22, these two pilots came back from their sortie, and the engineers are waiting there for them. And they get out of the airplanes, and they're going up to the engineers, and they got pads of paper full of notes. And they're looking at the engineers going, did you know the airplane would do this? Did you know it would do this? Did you know it would do this? And the engineers are going, what? It does what? And they're taking notes as fast as they can write down, because you give a fighter pilot a toy, he's going to play with it.
Sure.
And so the airplane does a lot of things that it wasn't originally thought that it was going to do. And basically the idea is to take these F-15Xs and fly them out there with the F-22s in the initial push towards the threat and let the F-22 do all the targeting for all the missiles that are not stealthy, the ones behind him. And with data links and stuff, he can do that. And then once, you know, the F-15s are Winchester, now he can go deeper using his stealth and his capabilities and take out whatever's left.
Interesting. I always wondered, when you start hanging a lot of ordnance and tanks and all kinds of stuff under the wings. How does that affect the aircraft aerodynamically? I mean, I can understand, or I can, I guess, appreciate the extra weight and the effect that that might have. But just from an aerodynamic standpoint, does it change the aircraft a lot?
I guess the easiest way to put it, it's like putting a trailer behind your car. You can still do 60 miles an hour. You're just going to take more gas to do it. You're not going to accelerate as fast. You can't turn as well. Nice thing about the F-15, the configuration is that even with most loads in the Strike Eagle, we could still pull 9 Gs initially. Couldn't sustain it like you could in the sea model, but you could still pull 9 Gs. The stores were actually designed for that. So it costs more gas,
yeah,
is the big thing. And you're not stealthy anymore with all that metal hanging on you.
All right, good. Let's talk about the 737 MAX 8. We have a couple of articles, some stories that we'll put in the show notes. There's some interesting history of the 737 MAX from NPR.
And NPR being National Public Radio for those outside of the country.
Right. Thank you, Micah. Also from Liam News, there's a story. Boeing didn't want to re-engine the 737, but had design standing by. Here's how I describe the 737 history, the 737 MAX history. It really revolves around the geared turbofan engine, right? I think you have this game-changing engine, and that ends up on the C series, which represents a potential threat to Boeing and Airbus. And Airbus responds first with the A320neo, which it offers with either the geared turbofan or the CFMI Leap X engine. And as a result of that, and the competitive advantage that it gave to Airbus, Boeing had to react with the 737 MAX. Boeing had originally wanted to design a new aircraft. You know, in this industry, in commercial aviation, timing is, I think, maybe one of the largest determinants of the winners and losers. It kind of depends on where you are in the cycle. Obviously, if you've just designed a bunch of new airplanes, your engineering resources are committed. Corporate funding is committed. You can't just design a new airplane anytime you would like to. And when you do, it takes time. But because Airbus was selling the 320neos, Boeing had to respond quickly with the 737 MAX and put that LEAP engine on the MAX. The difficulty, and we talked about this, I think, last week, is that the 737 is pretty low to the ground. And the new generation engines, because they have larger fans, are larger diameter. So Boeing had to do some interesting things with the 737NG in order to accommodate the larger, bigger, heavier engine. One is a taller front landing gear. I think, Jeff, the rear landing gear is the same. Is that correct?
Yes, the main gear is the same. The nose gear is 8 inches. The strut is 8 inches longer.
And the engine is a little farther forward.
It's quite a bit farther forward.
So we have these changes. Now, in looking at a lot of the stories in the press concerning the 737 MAX 8 crashes, the two crashes that we've talked about, I see a really broad range of accuracy in some of these articles. Some of them, to me, read like, you know that game, what do they call it? You know, where you one person whispers something in your
telephone.
Ear. Telephone. The telephone game. Some of the articles make me recall that game because they sort of read like someone who's got most of it right, but they're repeating things that they've heard before and didn't quite get it right. I don't know. Jeff, what do you think about what you see in the press these days?
That's a great way of putting it, Max. I mean, that makes a lot of sense in what I've heard and what I've read on television. They're talking about things, and it's pretty obvious that they're not experts and that they're kind of ad-libbing what they're talking about based on what they had. Maybe had an interview with a Boeing person or a 7-3 pilot or a technician or something, and then they're trying to put it in English, and they can't.
One of the things I was going to say, and I is that I think when we look back on this from, and we'll talk about it more, obviously, but when we look on it back on this from a sociological perspective, we're going to see the first grounding of an aircraft that took place because of social media.
There really was a strong and immediate and specific reaction, I think, in the press and in social media, like you say, Mike. One of the things that impressed me the most was the fact that they got 737 MAX 8, right? You know, usually it's not that specific, but they at least got that from the start. Rob, what do you think? Is the media doing a sufficient job in reporting the story, or are the stories associated with this?
I think Micah has it really pinned down. I think there was really a war that began shortly after, the Chinese grounded the airplanes, I think, on Sunday night, not long after the accident. And then the blocks started to fall the next few days with the Australians and the Brits and a few others. And then once it hit the EU, it really seemed like it went crazy. But again, I think the war of words was that we had, you know, two sides of our brains arguing. The pilots, I mean, and Boeing and the FAA saying, look, we're not making any decisions until we have some facts, and we don't have any facts. And you can understand that they don't want to ground an entire fleet of airplanes on non-scientific hearsay. But then you had the social media side, which Micah mentioned, which is the right side brain folks saying, you know, I'm not feeling real warm and fuzzy about this airplane here, and I don't think I really want to get on it. And what are you going to do about it? And then they would hit the left brain people who said, we don't have any information. We'll get back to you when we know more. It may take a while, but we'll do what we can, because that's how we always operate. And this time around, people said, not happening.
The sad part of this is not new to the 737. I mean, you're all old enough to remember, again, and I think this was the last time it happened, when US Air 73 went in at Pittsburgh, was the hard over rudder. And that was the final accident that was caused by that situation, where there were several accidents where the rudder just deflected, full deflection. And they could never figure it. They said it couldn't happen, and it kept happening every once in a while, and they finally fixed it. But those airplanes never got grounded. Whereas here we have two accidents, possibly by the same system, and the airplane's grounded. And I agree, it's between playing telephone and the social media, that's what caused a lot of the issue. We are such a instantaneous news society now that it just spread too fast.
Yeah, but look at the DC-10 groundings back in the 70s. I mean, we didn't have social media then. We didn't have the internet. And somehow, I don't know if it was McDonnell Douglas or if it was the FAA that took the tough action, but even without the same amount of pressure, they decided to take that airplane out of service.
Well, Jeff, you've flown both.
Yes, I have.
Flown the NG and the MAX. So,
I thought you were going to say the DC-10.
No. Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry.
I never flew the 10.
Yeah, yeah. So from a pilot's perspective, seat of the pants, how would you differentiate? Is there a big difference between them? Is there any difference between them?
The difference is all in the cockpit. As far as flying the airplane, the only big thing that stood out to me is the first time I flew it, it was from LA to DC, so we were pretty heavy. And as soon as I released the brakes to taxi, the airplane was moving. I hadn't had any power yet.
The taxi's at idle, huh?
It taxis at idle. It has carbon brakes versus steel brakes, so it stops better, which when you're going into DC at pretty close to max landing weight, that's a nice thing. I was actually very impressed with how it stopped at DC. So it didn't want to slow down on the ground, and it didn't want to slow down in the air either. It's a slick airplane. It's kind of annoying the first time you fly it because things are in different places. On the NG, the gear handle is just to the left of the first officer. On the MAX, it's in the middle. The flap gauge is on the dashboard, on the flat part facing you, whereas on the MAX, it's down laying flat in the middle, in front of the throttle. So the first time I had to look for what the flaps were, I couldn't find the flap cage. It's little things like that. A couple of the switches on the overhead panel are different everything does pretty much the same thing. In our emergency procedures, 99% of the procedures are the same. Interesting enough, there was no, and there still isn't, a separate emergency procedure for the Max and the NG when it comes to runaway trim. Hmm. It's still the same thing.
Does it need to be different?
In my opinion, yes. If that trim's going to run for 10 seconds, here's how we measure our trim settings in hundreds. Like our trim setting is typically like 5.81. You're going to tell me this thing can run 2.5 units of trim in 10 seconds? That's a lot of stinking trim. And I can't stop it without turning those switches off.
And you know what? We may have some listeners that don't really completely understand what trim means. So maybe we should explain that a little bit more.
It's like being able to adjust the strength of the power steering on your car from zero, no power steering at all, to like very light touch on the power steering. That's the best way I can put it. It has to do with how stiff the yoke is going to be, how much pressure you have to put on the yoke, either forward or aft, to hold it where you want to hold it. And you can trim it out so there's no forces on the yoke. So it'll, if you can actually fly the airplane hands off.
And that could be either pitch or yaw, right, with trim? Although in this case, we're talking about pitch with the issues with the Max, but trim could be pitch or yaw.
This is strictly a pitch function.
Did you feel like the Max 8 handled essentially the same as the NGs?
You know, I was surprised. I know from the training I had that when you come in to land on the Max, to make the nose position and to actually increase the drag, because it was so slick an airplane, the spoilers actually start to deploy when you get at your approach speed, to add a little more drag, to give you the same pitch attitude as an NG. I had no idea it was happening. You don't feel it at all. The nice thing about the 7.3 is it's very easy to trim the airplane hands off. And just, I mean, you could be in the climb or in cruise and just let go of everything and it stays right where you left it.
And so it's automatically doing what it needs to do?
No, it's not. It's not automatic. You actually have to physically trim it to do to that point.
And then it just holds?
And it just stays there.
Okay.
The 7.5 and 7.6 were not that easy to do when I flew those. I was actually surprised how easy it was to fly hands off.
Now, you mentioned training. Did you receive training on the Max? So we hear that, you know, a 1 hour iPad online course. Is that what you experienced?
I don't know how much time it actually was. I think it was like a series of 7 or 8 videos that went through system by system. And it pretty much just covered differences. My airline does not have a Max 8 sim. My understanding is only a handful in the world. Now, we're getting one come December, I think. I was just down at the schoolhouse in February, and they were talking about how they're going to get one later this year. I think it's December. But I read an article someplace yesterday where the simulator for the Max cannot simulate this MCAS runaway.
Probably because they don't expect it to be a possibility.
Right.
Yeah.
The thing that shocked me about the MCAS was it uses one angle of attack sensor.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a major design flaw.
Well, you know, when you only have two sensors, how do you compare them? So well, which one's wrong?
Well, if you get a miscompare, then you can take them both out of the system, you know, with a single one.
Yeah,
you know,
and
you,
that would be the way to do it.
Yeah.
I can tell you the limit in our performance is the AOA can be out of whack by 0.5 units between the left side and the right side. The news has talked about the two optional safety features that neither Lion Aero or Ethiopian had purchased. My airline has both, which is nice. So I have an angle of attack indicator on my primary flight display, as does the co-pilot, and I also have it up on my HUD. And if we get more than 0.5 units apart between any of them, we get a caution light.
And then if you get that caution light, the action you would take would be?
Ignore it. There'd probably be some other things that would go along with it. You'd probably have an indicated airspeed disagree or an altitude disagree because something's wrong on one side of the airplane.
So I'm wondering, have we found other aircraft where the AOA was being used as, you know, an input to the primary flight controls as opposed to simply being additional, you know, information? You know, if it's just additional information and fails, no big deal. And manufacturers might not even worry about the failure rate on a system like that. But, you know, have other airplanes been using AOA in that way?
Oh, yes. Look at Air France 447, the one that crashed off of Rio. Every Airbus uses angle of attack. Every flight data recorder records angle of attack. Every airplane, every commercial airplane out there records angle of attack on their flight data recorder. We just can't see it on most of the airplanes. I always thought that was absolutely ridiculous.
And you're saying that the fly-by-wire system in the Airbus takes that as an input and controls the airplane accordingly based on AOP input?
Yeah, and like, and the 7-3 is not fly-by-wire, and it uses the angle of attack even without the, even on the NG.
So let me ask a stupid question, as I'm not a pilot, not as familiar with these things as many others, but you in the airline that you fly, you do have the AOA indicator, and you have the red light that lets you know if it's out of sync. But if you didn't have that, would you feel comfortable flying the 737 MAX, and would you feel that it would be a not just a detriment, it's a good additional information, but is it necessary information? Could you fly it? And if we're talking about the MCAS, that's the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, if that was out of alignment, would you have? Can you still maneuver and figure out what's going on?
Once we all knew that the MCAS was there, I think you'll find that we would all react the same. We would react differently than before, when we didn't know that the system was even on the airplanes. That was the biggest shock. We did not know the system was there. I can't even get a hold of a maintenance guy to talk to me about the MCAS system.
Because they don't know either.
Yeah, the amount of information out there is not very much.
And that could have been, or you know, we're not speculating what it was. We're just talking about one of the things it could have been is that the pilots may not have been familiar in knowing that it was there to know to shut it down is what I guess we're saying.
Well, my understanding is both the Lion Air guys and the Ethiopian guys were trained on the MAX systems. Now, they wouldn't have been trained on MCAS, although the Ethiopian guys should have been. My understanding is they were, but the Lion Air guys knew they had had MAX training, but they still didn't know about the MCAS system. So they were still digging through the checklist trying to figure out what was going on when they hit the ground.
But in all these airplane accidents, these guys must have been hand-flying the airplane, right? Because
yes, when the autopilot is on, the MCAS does not come into play.
Uh-huh.
The problem is when the MCAS fires, like it did on both, possibly did on both of these, you can't get the autopilot back on because there's too much load on the autopilot to take over.
Sure. Yeah, and that was one of the strange parts of the Ethiopian accident, because everybody that I knew, I mean, even when I saw the bulletin come from one of the airline books that explained what they thought it was that was happening. I mean, everybody kind of anecdotally shared that in the U.S. real quick. And it is hard to understand how these guys in that part of the world didn't get that. But then that's the one part of this whole accident chain that bothers me, is that we have that regional issue. Both of these accidents happened in other parts of the world where, you know, airline traffic isn't as intense as it is here in the States. And it makes everybody wonder, well, how are these people trained? You know, as you said, with the Indonesia, the Lion Air accident, they went through the same training everybody else did and nobody knew about it. So no big deal. I mean, except for the accident, of course. But I'm saying later, it just seems hard to understand, hard to believe even, that the Ethiopian carrier could not have passed this information down to its pilots.
Well, they did. And the captain and the first officer actually had been in the simulator. But like I said, the sim can't simulate what happens in this situation. Ethiopian, by the way, has a very good track record. They're one of the better airlines over in Africa, as far as they fly wide bodies all over, I mean, all up to the EU and other places in the world. Where Lion Air is kind of, they've had a questionable track record over the years.
So you're saying that the Ethiopian airline ops folks shared all of these tips with the crew of the airplane that went down?
Well, I don't know if you'd call them tips, but they did the training. I don't know what their version of the FAA dictated. Like, we have an air directive that had to be implemented within like 3 days, and it's funny because it was day four when I flew the MAX for the first time. And you didn't think I was doing a lot of reading? Oh, baby.
Yeah.
I went through all the MAX training over again the night before. I was on a long layover in Los Angeles, and I went through all those videos all over again. I kept them on my iPad because I knew I wasn't going to see the MAX for a while. So because it had been like a year since I'd watched those videos.
Oh, really? Oh.
Well, the airplane was only doing certain routes, and they're routes that I don't fly.
Okay.
And now that they were starting to move out into the system on certain of the, especially the longer routes like Transcons, because it's got great legs compared to the NG. So I kept them just for that reason, because I knew the first time I flew it, it was going to be later.
So based on what we know now, in terms of, you know, your familiarity with the familiarity with MCAS and the understanding of some of the systems in place, the lack of an AOA or the indicators on many of those aircraft, what do you, Jeff, and I guess Rob and Max, because you're the pilots, how do you feel about the grounding? Do you think that was necessary, or do you think we just needed to pass out information?
No, I, if you're asking me personally, I think it was necessary because we don't know what happened to the second airplane. We understand that there are some very similar movements of the airplane, but we still do not know for certain that what brought down the first one is what brought down the second one. And once you lose the confidence of the public, and it wasn't just in one country, it was globally. I don't see how they could have kept the thing flying.
I agree with Rob. I think it needed to be done because there's so much. I won't speculate on what happened on either one because neither accident reports come out. Oh, the MCAS is figured in pretty dramatically in a Lion Air from the preliminaries. But, I mean, the Ethiopian's still in its infancy. But I think the airplane needed to be grounded because it's such a social media society. People would – I mean, I've had passengers ask me, you know, is this a MAX, even after the grounding. So – there's a lot of nervous flyers out there already. We don't need any more. I think it's something that's going to have to be looked at severely because we don't know what it is right now.
With the training that you have as a pilot, having flown it, would you be uncomfortable flying it?
No. I can. At my company, we download our FDR data about once a week, and the company and the union go through it. And it's either 14, I can't remember if it's 14,000 hours or 14,000 flights. We have not seen a single anomaly on a MAX in regarding to any kind of trim runaway. So it's a reliable system. I don't know if it's how we do our maintenance versus how other countries do it. I'm not going to go there. But I can tell you what my airline's experience is. And and my own experience, I've had no problem with the airplane. I know if it happened to me, I would turn that thing into a 70-ton 172 in a heartbeat. I would just turn the trim off, and I'd have a hand crank on the trim wheel, and I'd be a 70-ton 172 doing manual trim.
But you know something, I didn't understand when I first started following this, Jeff, is that I thought that if the MCAS triggered while they were hand flying it, and it started to get away from people, and they flipped the stab trim switches by the throttle quadrant, that once they got the nose level again, the system would reset and could do it all over again.
No. If the AOA condition remains, if you have this high angle of attack, it's going to drive the MCAS to drive the nose for 10 seconds at up to 2.5 degrees in those 10 seconds. Once those 10 seconds are over, it sits there and looks for 5 more seconds. If the situation is still there, it's going to run it again for 10 seconds. So the second time it fires, it's going to be at the stop. You're going to be full nose down trim. Now, when you turn those two switches off, you have disconnected, literally just turned the power off to all of your trim. The motors cannot run. That's what bothered the Lion Air guys so much. On the NG, if you get a trim runaway, you either say it's running full nose down like the MCAS drives it. In an NG, if you pull or trim in the opposite direction, that stops the electric motors from trimming the airplane. It puts a brake on them. The MCAS ignores that input. It ignores you pulling on the yoke. It ignores your trim inputs. It keeps running the trim forward. That's what got the Lion Air guys. They couldn't figure out why they couldn't stop the trim. And when I read that, it made my hair stand up. That's why, I mean, if I see the trim wheel starting to spin at an abnormal rate, I'm going to reach over and turn those two switches off, and I'll be declaring a mayday, and I'll be landing in a 70-ton 172.
Now, Boeing is supposed to be coming out soon with some kind of a change. And I thought it was very interesting in the earlier articles in the press, it was called a software fix. But now I'm seeing it being called a software update. And people have, pretty consistently changed the terminology they're using in their reports. Do you have any idea what Boeing is going to be introducing as a change?
The only change that I know of for sure is that everybody's going to get an angle of attack gauge. That's just, as I know, Southwest has already ordered them because their airplanes didn't have them. In fact, I was just on a Facebook page about 7-3s, and they were sitting in a, these two captains were sitting in a MAX, and the first thing I noticed is I could see the primary flight director on both sides, and they were in an airplane that did not have AOA. So that's going to be not an option anymore. It's just going to come with the airplane. As far as whether it's an update or a software, I think you're talking semantics in what you're going to call it.
Yeah, except that the earlier articles, when they call it a software fix, I mean, I think it set in people's minds that this was all caused by a software bug. So they were going to fix the software. But they're not really fixing anything, right? They're, I mean, based on what we understand the Boeing is going to do, they're going to provide some additional source of information. Isn't that the way you could look at it?
Well, I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth, Max, what they're going to do.
Okay.
I got the impression from some of the articles I read that it is a fix. It's not that the software is wrong. It does more than it should. To run the trim for 10 seconds is way too much. I don't care how high the nose is. That's still way too much trim, in my opinion, in comparison to what we normally use for trim. I mean, that's a huge amount of trim.
What do you think of the fact, Jeff, that in the – I'm sure you probably read the Seattle Times story that came out last weekend in which Dominic Gates – spoke about the engineers at Boeing and FAA both that he interviewed, who said they told the company that this was not a real good idea and that they just kind of blew him off. That's really frightening, especially when we see now that, you know, people that fly the airplane regularly would say it's going to crank in how much trim?
Oh,
how quickly? Have you lost your mind?
The discussions amongst the pilots has been absolutely just that. It is shocking. We're just dumbfounded by the whole thing when we found out what it was doing, that we didn't know about it.
See, that's the part. That's where the conspiracy theories are probably going to emerge. We didn't tell anybody about it because he really didn't need to know about it, because if it ever happened, it would look a lot like a trim runaway or a stab trim runaway. And by the way, if we did tell them, they'd probably be really upset that we'd set the limits. Like, you can see how people could read that and say, this doesn't sound very good.
I got my emergency procedures right here, and I just had this out because I can tell you the steps for, the difference between stab runaway and the MCAS. It looks the same initially until you go to correct the issue. Let's see. There's 1, 2, 3, 4. The fifth step is to reach for the stab trim cutout switches.
Right. Because most people would think, oh, I know what to do. I've flown the NG. You just add some back pressure on the control wheel and it's going to stop it.
Yes.
And then it doesn't.
It doesn't. And you're going, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So it's a little confusing. I think, you know, some of the other stuff I read, there's conjecture that maybe the FAA just let Boeing certify the airplane themselves without a whole lot of FAA input. I've seen that scuttlebutt going around. And if that's true, it's going to be a software fix to the FAA standards versus the Boeing standard.
Yeah, and we also have some noise about a criminal investigation here. I'm not sure that that's the sort of thing that we're either ready for or want to see.
Yeah, I think you're going to, no matter what, I think you're going to see some civil lawsuits.
Sure. Oh, yes.
In this country, because there were Americans on the Ethiopian flight.
Yeah, it's going to be very expensive, I think.
There's no doubt about that. And Boeing stock has dropped considerably. But the criminal investigation into Boeing, that's where I just don't see. It's the social media again. I don't see where there's any criminality necessarily involved. If there is, I'll be surprised. But you know, the idea that Boeing is in cahoots with the FAA on certification, I don't think people understand how certification works.
Yeah, but I also think that this is probably a one of those watershed moments where it looks different from what it may actually have been. I mean, maybe Boeing wasn't hiding something. The problem is that you can't argue with the facts. They didn't tell anybody that this system was there. And they didn't tell them how it was going to operate. And even after the first accident, they you know, they talked about it, but I when I read the bulletin on the Max, it didn't seem to be an act of urgency. It almost seemed as if it was repeating what we'd all been trained for. And let me tell you, this is a hell of a lot different. So then, Micah, my point is that who knew? I mean, the engineers designed it. They knew what they designed. Did they not tell the people higher up? Did they not understand what, that kind of action in the air would translate into? It could all be just a really ugly coincidence. It's like PR. PR is not about the facts. It's about how it looks.
Well, Rob, I'll kind of go back to what I said about the F-22 when they first came back from that first red flag. I mean, the engineers designed the system to do a certain thing. What's it actually doing in the airplane is another thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe the engineer, I don't know if the engineers are pilots or not, or actually fly the airplane. I know the test pilots are, they're well-trained. Do they fire the MCAS in flight? I don't think so. I know the simulators.
Well, no, and why would they?
Yeah.
It just wouldn't make any sense for them to try that. But then again, that's where this whole certification thing is coming up too, I think, is that people are saying, okay, wait a minute. You added something that really changed the way that the airplane flew in certain kinds of situations. You didn't tell anybody about it. Guys, one of you had to know somewhere what the Sam Hill this thing would do if it ever fired. Now,
you would hope.
You thought it would never fire, but you should have at least given the pilots the benefit of the doubt to tell them the system even existed.
Yes.
Well, and doesn't it also go back to how we test aircraft these days? I think I spoke about it once at a piece a long time ago that, we don't put planes in stalls and things like that. We test everything in a simulator. Everything is software. We don't know how planes actually react because we only test things in a simulator these days.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, Mike, because we have to now in the simulator do full stall training. Boeing never stalled a 737.
Exactly.
So how do you design a sim program to stall the airplane that's never been stalled?
That's exactly what I said in my piece.
Another issue here is maybe sort of the larger one of the credibility or the influence of the FAA. We like to think that the rest of the world heeds the views of the FAA, right? And this is a case where just the opposite happened. Do you think that the FAA doesn't have the global influence or credibility that it seemed to have had in the past?
Well, when the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder went to France instead of back to the United States,
that
really got my attention.
Hmm.
Yeah, I agree.
That was a big surprise when I saw that.
And you can understand that. And going back to this whole, I need a better word than conspiracy because I'm not trying to turn it into something that it's not. But when you have other countries around the world that normally look to the United States for leadership that say, the way they're running their country these days, and Boeing's a big company and the FAA's being run by a temp, and I don't know. I don't feel real comfy with that. We've never experienced those kinds of things, at least not to my knowledge. That's even more sad.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, as independent as the NTSB is from the FAA, that's a big feather in our cap versus a lot of the other investigative services worldwide. But when it went to France, I was, why are they sending it there? Oh, I get it.
Well, all of us, of course, in these conversations, don't mean to minimize the human life that's been lost and the huge numbers of families, friends, and relatives that are impacted by these two accidents. So we probably don't talk enough about that. But
yeah, it's over 300 people between the two accidents.
Right, just staggering. And so, of course, it's always also difficult to talk about these things when we don't have the results of the investigations yet. So, I mean, these things could go in who knows what direction after some good investigative work. So we'll have to be patient.
And people want action, and a good NTSB investigation can take upwards of 2 years or more. And we're not going to know for sure the final results for at least that long.
Well, right now, I know my company's looking at least 5 weeks before the next MAX flies. They have been taken off the schedule till the end of April.
Now, so that's interesting because, and I've read that, because I gather that that's so that the customer, the flying public, wouldn't be negatively impacted by, schedules that assume that the fleet will be up again in so many days or so many weeks, and then it doesn't happen, and so it changes again, and then it changes again after that. That's my impression, that they're pushing it out that far, not because necessarily they know, when they'll be able to fly again, but it pushes it out a little bit past the planning horizon of a lot of their customers. Is that an accurate way to look at that, do you think?
I think it's actually more planning for the part of the company. And how do we fill the schedule?
Okay.
I mean, we're going to have to look at everything from scheduled maintenance to how many times an aircraft flies a day. Right now, I think we're canceling like 90 flights a day, and we only have 24. Now, Southwest, it's 5% of their fleet. That's a big chunk. You look at Norwegian, where they're actually wet leasing airplanes to fill their schedules. They were going to sell some airplanes. Now they're not.
The other thing, and remember, I'm a bit jaded sometimes, is that I suspect that 5 weeks is basically because you got to wait for the news cycle to calm down, and 5 weeks is about right.
You are jaded, Micah.
I think it's going to take more than the news cycle to calm down on this one, though, Micah. I think that,
I agree.
Boeing has a serious black eye this time, and as they used to say for this, us old folks that used to remember the Lucille Ball comedy show, where Desi would say, "You got some splaining to do,"
And I remember.
And the public's not going to be on Boeing's side. I mean, they see them as a huge corporation making money hand over fist. And I'm just saying, with the year or two that we've had with focus on corporations, people are a little skeptical.
I question my flight attendants, "Well, what are you guys hearing from the passengers?" And I try to instill in my flight attendants my faith in the airplane based on my flying skills and the homework that I've done. I think I've probably done more homework than some guys have and trying to keep up with this. And I know the public is frightened of the airplane.
Yeah. I think there probably isn't anything I can think of that would be much worse for Boeing than what's happened here, which is unfortunate for sure.
We could always start a rumor that Airbus is about to make an offer on Boeing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that would really mess up their week. Or Embraer. No, that's right. They already bought the commercial side of Embraer. So yeah. Maybe the other side of Embraer, the executive jet, could buy the Boeing. No, I guess not. Okay.
An Embraer BBJ?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for that. That's been a great conversation on this topic. And, Jeff, it's been really wonderful to have you here and provide your perspective on this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Now we're going to play the interview that Rob and I conducted with Sarah Nelson earlier today. We got her on the phone and had a conversation with her. She, of course, as I mentioned, is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. And Rob, she represents, United Flight Attendants. Others as well?
Yeah, United, Frontier, Spirit, I forgot how many others, Air Wisconsin, let's see, Southwest, I believe. Well, wait a minute. I don't know if the Southwest attendants are AFA or if they have their own union like the pilots do. I should know this, but I don't. But the one thing I was going to say is that I think what makes the interview interesting is the fact that Sarah's a very take charge kind of lady. Without sounding like she's being pushy, she is just not willing to settle for the status quo. And I think that comes across very clearly in the interview and how special we are in this particular industry, because especially pilots and flight attendants, we have kind of been brought up to say, no, I'm not going to buy that. I think we need to come to a meeting of the mind somewhere. And that is not like the rest of the economy, and it hasn't been for a long time. So younger listeners that have not been experienced or had any experience with unions might find that conversation pretty interesting.
All right, let's play that now. This is Max Flight, and I'm here with Rob Mark, and we're speaking with Sarah Nelson, the International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, AFL-CIO. Now, Sarah took office in June 2014. She's currently serving her second four-year term. Sarah became a United Airlines flight attendant in 1996 and has been a union activist since nearly the beginning of her flying career. She served as strike chair and lead communications for nearly 10 years at AFA's United chapter. Sarah, as you'll find, is very passionate about AFA's mission to achieve fair compensation, job security, and improved quality of life, as well as safe, healthy, and secure aircraft cabin for both passengers and crew. Now, Sarah, thanks for talking with us. You and the union have been quite vocal lately, appearing in the press frequently. For example, when we had the partial government shutdown here in the United States, I believe you called for a general strike. What made you feel that strongly?
Well, we had 2 million people out of work, or hundreds and hundreds of thousands of workers forced to come to work without pay. While it was a partial government shutdown, it was a total government shutdown for aviation. So all the federal programs that touch aviation and work in partnership with our private companies was shut down. We had essential employees coming to work, our air traffic controllers, our transportation security officers, for example. But all of the programs that support the work that they do were not running in the background. So any sort of infrastructure improvements, any training to bring new people on the line, any of the security assessments that happen that help give the TSOs the briefings every day before they do their security screening, and any advance, the knowledge that helps us understand where we may have some gaps in the safety or security programs in place. Those background functions were not operating. So as we went on in this government shutdown, and we hit finally day 35, this was more than twice as long as any government shutdown in the past. And if you think about the safety nets that have to be in place, the security safety nets that have to be in place to keep aviation safe and secure. If you have a shutdown of a few days and people haven't missed paychecks and programs are still sort of running on the steam that was already in place, you can probably survive for a little while. But every single day that you go on and those programs are not in place, you're not replacing frontline employees, you're not staffing properly, you have more and more people in safety sensitive jobs who must do their job without any distractions. And we know this as flight attendants. When we go to our recurrent safety training, the first thing they say is remove all distractions when performing safety work. Well, the biggest distraction you can give someone is to say, you have to come to work. You have to come to work and do your job. If you don't come to work, we might even think that this is a job action and you can be criminally prosecuted for that if you don't come. And if you don't come, you can also maybe never work here again. You may lose your health care, your right to ever work for the federal government, but we're going to require you to come to work, but we're not going to pay you. Forget taking care of your family, forget being able to have a second job through this time and ride this out. We need you to come to work and not get paid. And in private industry, you'd have at least a 60-day warning for being out of work. You would never work a single day without getting paid. That's something we gave up a long time ago in this country. So this was a very serious time. And as I talked about it, when I called for discussion around conducting a general strike to end that shutdown, this was about 2 million people directly being affected. All the rest of us who were going to work in an increasingly unsafe situation at work. And at what time had we ever had conditions like that in this country? If there was any time to call for a general strike to put an end to the madness, that was the time. That was the reasoning that we gave. And that was the sense of urgency that we were working with as that government shutdown continued on with what looked like at the time no end in sight.
Sarah, tell me, for a lot of people that have not traveled outside the United States, perhaps, they might not know what a general strike is. Can you give us an idea of what that meant?
A general strike is really, and there is a lot of confusion around this because there hasn't been a general strike in this country for almost 100 years. And when there was a general strike in this country, it was only by specific cities. So we were saying nationwide, let's have a general strike. And what that means is everyone taking part in this strike, all the citizens rising up and saying, we need to put a stop to this. We're not going to go to work. We're going to stop the country, and we're going to require our representatives to get busy and put in place a budget that has the federal programs running that keep all of us safe. So this is not just, it would have to start with the labor movement, and I was calling on the labor movement to start it, but this was really a call to everyone who goes to work to say, we're all in this together. We all have to be safe. We're going to stand up for our country. We're going to stand up for these people who are being forced to come to work or who are out of work without getting paid right now. And we're all going to just put the country at a stop until this is resolved.
Sarah, do you think we're at a new point in history where labor unions have maybe an increased role or an increased imperative for taking action in situations like this?
You know, what's interesting about this is that quietly I was hearing from many people in industry saying that they were cheering for me. They were cheering for our union and calling for this action because they feel like the pendulum has swung too far in one direction. And there's not really a balance of powers. There's not there's too much a continual squeeze and a requirement from Wall Street to squeeze more and more in stock buybacks and in eking out those revenues to give big payoffs to a small number of people. And more people are working harder for less, being more and more productive in this country, sometimes working two and three jobs to get by and not really earning a living wage. And you can only stretch that rubber band so far until it breaks. All of a sudden, you don't have people who can buy the goods and services that we're trying to sell and can't contribute to the communities, can't even contribute to the taxes that are necessary to run those communities. So there were a lot of people who were saying, this is really refreshing, this call, first of all, for solidarity, that we all take action together, that we understand that we've got a common interest in the federal government running and in working together. And I heard, all over the country from workers who are excited, who have been squeezed for so long and have felt like there have been no answers until they started to see some of the teachers rising up and some of the other work actions happening around the country, but also to from every end of the spectrum saying that we have polarized the discussion so terribly in this country that we have gotten to a place of legislating by budget process, which was never intended, puts us, up to cliff bargaining every time, is not solutions oriented, and will just keep driving us down to a lower and lower denominator here that really at a certain point will just grind our country to a halt, not allow us to compete with the world. So we do believe that there's a resurgence in labor, absolutely. There's an important role that labor has to play here because labor really is a check and balance on a capitalist society. And it keeps a level of fairness running. And people who today feel like there's no hope and feel like they're getting further and further behind actually have the ability to feel like they can have some say in that system if they join together with the other people in their workplace. And that's what we're seeing. People are excited about that. And if you look at the polling, unions and the labor movement are gaining steam in terms of public excitement in wanting to join a union and favorability on the view of unions and the role that unions play in this country. And so while many, many political people in politics and other ideas may be polarized, but the labor movement keeps gaining steam in terms of public favorability. And there has been a snapback from the persistent drumbeat by the Chamber of Commerce and those who really wanted to beat down unions and have persistently done that over the last several decades. And people have really hit a point where they are really just hurting so badly that they're looking for answers and they're realizing, oh, we could have power together. And if you look at the results that AFA has gotten in the last several months by taking action and by being absolute in our mission to provide a safe transportation system and to provide economic justice for the people that we represent, and taking a hard line on that and saying what it is that we're willing to do to stand up for those things, we get results well before ever having to take any action. You know, I saw something yesterday on the first charter school strike. Some of the activists who have organized some of the charter schools have worked at trying to actually take on this issue of the charter schools and have organizing there and have contracts there for the teachers who are working there. And they said it was very, very hard to get to that first strike because every time they started talking about strike, people would settle. So the strike is an important part of collective bargaining, and everyone has to understand what they are willing to do in an environment of collective bargaining, what they're willing to do to stand on their own positions. And what it does is it encourages compromise. It encourages people to come to solutions rather than just standing their ground and keeping us from moving forward. So, yes, I believe there's a resurgence. I believe people are open to this. I believe that there are even some people in management fields who recognize the importance of it. And there's other people who are looking at the bigger problems that we're facing in this world, climate change and the problem of not providing health care to people in this country and the growing costs there, and the problem with the attack on pension plans that has put us in a position where the multi-employer pension plans may collapse, which could cause a bigger crash on the stock market than we saw with the housing bubble. These things are very serious issues that we have to take on, and we have to be in a position where we can seek solutions rather than just feel like there isn't anything and we're throwing up our hands. And that's what labor is providing to people.
Compromise is a pretty ugly word these days, it seems to me. And it doesn't, I'm not referring to one side or the other, but everybody says, you know, the world would be great if it wasn't for those guys. And over the years, having grown up in a lot of union jobs, I always thought it was interesting to work for someone that says, well, this is the way it's going to be. And you go, well, why is it like that? Hey, you don't like it? There's the door. And that's what most of this generation, say a generation and a half of people, have grown up believing, that when the boss says that's it, there is no compromise. There's no bargaining. It's their way or the highway. And that's just not what we're used to in aviation. So why do you think aviation has managed to hold on so tightly to the labor side?
So aviation workers are 80% organized, and thanks for recognizing that. And aviation unions have been a huge part of participating in building the safety regulations that keep us safe, in promoting procedures, reporting systems that allow us to move from a reactionary model to a critical incident or an accident, to actually moving more to a risk-based model where we can actually predict when there is too much risk in the system, and we can adjust what we're doing because of that. And that has been, those have all been procedures that unions have promoted, that working people on the front lines having a say and bringing their direct experience to this and recognizing, you know, that management had to recognize that people have to take for granted that they're going to be safe on a plane in order for people to buy tickets. That's safety is fundamental. And I was just, with some people on the Hill earlier today, and they said, you know, I realized during the 737 MAX issue that, yeah, when I go to the plane, I just take for granted that it's going to be safe. It hasn't always been that way. We went through a string of accidents in the 90s that led to some of these changes that put in place the safest transportation system in the world. I mean, our regulations are written in blood, but it was the unions who really pushed those solutions forward. And it was the management understanding that if they didn't have safety as a number one, they weren't actually going to be able to sell tickets. I think those two things have allowed labor to have a deeper role in what aviation looks like. And because of our density in aviation, management has been reticent to take on unions because it's a huge distraction from simply running the airline. And in most cases, it's a fact of life that they have to bargain union contracts. And not all of them like it. Some of them have tried to get around that from time to time. But at the end of the day, the ones who are successful are the ones who realize that labor's there. And if labor's there, you're going to have the best way that you can operate is to have a good relationship with labor, to actually use the structures that labor has in place in order to run a business that doesn't have a lot of disruption. And I'll give you an example of this. We have an AFA EAP program that runs just by the union, totally separate from the company. And the companies where we have mature programs, we actually have management referring flight attendants to EAP because if they recognize that someone is in trouble, but there hasn't been an incident at work, they're referring those people to AFA EAP. We're handling all of these, what would otherwise be HR issues. And people, we can actually tell you through our statistics here and all of our internal data that these people are returning to work 18% faster because we're able to get to them sooner and help them work through those issues. So they're much more productive at work, and it lowers the cost for the airline, and it allows them to have fewer disruptions and allows them actually to have fewer management handling HR problems. These are some of the things that labor does in aviation and in other places, but where airline management has had to recognize it because of the density in aviation. And even if they don't come to aviation thinking that unions are a good thing, they may not leave aviation thinking unions are a good thing, but they would leave saying it's a necessary thing for aviation to run, be successful, and be as safe as it is today.
Sure. And we should mention that EAP is an employee assistance program that includes things like counseling and that sort of thing. Does an EAP normally add anything else to the process?
So our employee assistance program is also a professional standards program. We encourage flight attendants actually to write to the union when they have an experience on the job, a conflict on the job with a coworker. So we try to manage issues and keep them out of getting entangled in a disciplinary process. And we get resolutions a lot faster that way. But these are services that are provided. Let's say someone is in a financial crisis for some reason. We respond to natural disasters, respond to critical incidents like an aircraft accident. If you think about it, anytime there is a terrorist event around the world, we very likely have crews in that city. So we've got EAP responding to crews overseas. Who have been in cities where there has been an attack, confirming that everyone's okay, seeing if they were near the incident. We had EAP responding to the shooting in Las Vegas, the shooting at the Pulse Club in Orlando. And so those critical incidents, it's very important to have a good response there. But there's also substance abuse and depression and all of these issues that are very difficult to deal with in an open way. We have a confidential process where people can get the help that they need, get the referrals that they need, and have the follow-up to really take the steps that they need to be a fully functioning member of society and a contributing employee at the airline.
Hmm. Sarah, I'd like to take a look at some of the other examples of cases where the AFA has had a meaningful impact. And maybe looking at the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2018 could give us some examples. You had a number of legislative victories, I think, in that act.
Yes, we had 18 legislative victories in that act. And first and foremost for us was improving our rest. We've had a 30-year campaign to address flight attendant fatigue, and it's been through 7 congressionally mandated fatigue studies where we finally were able to have science show that flight attendant fatigue exists. Those studies gave recommendations about how to address it. The top recommendation is to make sure flight attendants have more rest. If you can believe it, that's how best you can combat fatigue, is to get more rest. But there's other provisions as well. So we, our leading issue in the FAA reauthorization bill was improving flight attendant rest from 8 hours to 10 hours, understanding that within that time, you're also going back and forth between the airport and the hotel. So at 8 hours, you may have 3 or 4 hours in the bed by the time everything's said and done, if you can get yourself calmed down and get to sleep. But with 10 hours, you actually have a chance at getting better rest to be able to recover in between 14-hour duty days. So that was a key item, as was a fatigue risk management plan where flight attendants can report instances of fatigue and we can address other outliers in the schedules that are maybe causing fatigue. And we can have a constant assessment of that between the union, the company, and the FAA. So that we're eradicating flight attendant fatigue from the system, and we can actually respond to the emergencies that we're charged to respond to when they occur, whether it's health or there's something wrong with the aircraft, a decompression, a fire, whatever that may be. And quite frankly, more and more, we have to de-escalate situations on the airplane, because as you have more people crammed into smaller seats closer together, the most common thing that we're having to do today is de-escalate conflict between passengers. And that's not a great thing to do when you're fatigued. And I don't think there's a passenger out there who would say it's a good idea to have a fatigued flight attendant working their flight.
What is, I was going to say, so the 10 hours rest is in place now for your members. Is that correct?
So what's really concerning, and even more so concerning about the shutdown, is that everything stops. So implementation, there's well over 300 initiatives, and well over 1,000 if they're metered out into specific subjects, of initiatives for the safety of aviation and for improving infrastructure. None of those have been implemented yet. That this bill was passed on October 3rd, signed into law on October 5th. There's a whole, there, you can recognize that anytime you have to implement something as large as that, there does have to be a little bit of an assessment and a schedule for getting that done. So maybe it's understandable that that wouldn't have happened before the holidays. But when the shutdown occurred, all of that work stopped. And now the Department of Transportation and the FAA is attempting to get that back up and running. The FAA just recently, the administration has announced a nominee for the new FAA administrator. So we've got an acting administrator working, who also then had to deal with the issue of the 737 MAX. So our 10 hours have not been implemented, nor have any of the other provisions in the FAA reauthorization bill been implemented. And so we are really pressing to make sure all of those things are get moving. Other important provisions were a study on evacuation standards, so taking into consideration the current cabin environment and whether or not that would have an impact on the ability to get everyone off a plane in 90 seconds. That needs to be reviewed. That data has not been updated since the 80s.
Yeah, that's something, Sarah, that we've talked about quite a few times on the Airplane Geeks podcast. And we talk about how when you assemble, or when the OEM assembles an army of people to participate in the 90-second evacuation test, that it's not very representative of the kinds of passengers you'd actually find on an airplane.
Yeah, everybody's in their tennis shoes and they're all 18 years old, right?
So, right.
But also, though, it's been a very long time since we've actually done one of those tests. And our, as you know, our aircraft cabins have changed a lot. Those seats are closer together. Guess what? Body mass has increased on average in this country. And we have people plugged in now all over the place. The carry-on bags, everything is full in the cabin. People have electronic devices that they have in their hands that may serve as projectiles in these events. And are we considering that? Have we considered the fact that still today there's an exception for children under the age of 2 and they can sit on a parent's lap? Well, you know, in the old days, when I first started flying, often there were seats and the parents could bring a car seat on and still put their child in that car seat. And there was room and the space and the ability to really keep everyone safe. Today, there is no empty seat. There is no ability to bring those car seats on because you already have luggage everywhere. So if there's not a seat to put them in, they're getting checked. And we have now babies who, in turbulence or in an accident, could also become projectiles and get hurt. So that is another initiative that we'll be taking up that isn't in the FAA reauthorization bill. But these are current day concerns that have been in place for many, many years, but have been exacerbated because of the conditions in the aircraft cabin today. And we need to take a real look at what's happening in the aircraft cabin, what's happened because of the reconfiguration of our planes, and how that should apply to the regulations that make sense for safety today.
I think an interesting question I would ask is that when I was listening to your comment before about the 737 situation, and I think it was yesterday in the paper, I read something about some simulator sessions that they did in Africa where they proved that if the pilots had done something they were supposed to do or whatever, they could have landed the airplane safely. And my point is that, you know, we talk about these evacuation procedures, but what we don't talk about is the startle factor that this gets sprung on people in real life when they least expect it. And putting a bunch of people in an airplane that aren't representative anymore, like some of the situations you just mentioned, is silly because they're not real people and they know it's coming. They're just waiting for somebody to say, go, and then everybody runs out.
Yeah, loaded spring.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
That's right. So, you know, when I go to my annual training, one of the biggest things that we do is practice our commands, practice our immediate response. Flight attendants are trained to get people out in that situation because we're able to recall that training because it's something that we do in a silent review every single time we go to work, and then we go to this recurrent training every year. And if we didn't have that, there would be the concern that shock would take over and we wouldn't be able to respond. So you have to have emergency procedures that you call on right away that are really rote in your head so that you don't have to think. And that's how we're able to respond. But the passengers themselves, you bring up a very good point. Everyone is taking for granted that they're safe on a plane, that they don't have to think about this, that they're taking their shoes off before we even take off. And so when those incidents happen, they really, in most cases, people in that situation will go into shock. They do need very deliberate commands to tell them what to do. And that's just not realistic in an evacuation drill where people know what's coming at them and they're thinking about it and preparing for it in their mind.
I just finished a book recently about the horrible crash there was in Tenerife back some 40 years ago where two 747s ran together on the ground when one was trying to take off. And the person that wrote the book did some incredible research, but he mentioned how many people lost their lives because they did not – it's not that they did not know what to do, but they were waiting for someone to tell them what to do, probably because they were in shock. But without the flight attendants being there, many of those people lost their lives because they just sat in the wreckage doing absolutely nothing when they could have escaped.
Hmm. Yeah, it's really important that flight attendants are on the plane for that reason. And also, the data shows that those who actually pay attention during the safety instruction video or presentation by the flight attendants increase their likelihood of getting out of a plane safely because they've already got that in their mind a little bit. So yeah, people who where an incident is thrown at someone quickly and they're put in a position of having to respond, it's most likely that human nature will take over and they won't know what to do and they will sit there in shock and not be able to respond in a way that's going to be helpful for themselves.
One of the campaigns efforts that really impressed me is this Eyes in the Skies program. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about what that involved and your role?
Sure. So in 2015, we decided to initiate a campaign called 100,000 Eyes in the Skies. There's approximately 100,000 U.S. flight attendants, and we wanted to be eyes in the skies to uncover what was hidden in plain sight. and that is human trafficking on our planes. So if we could be trained and become aware of human trafficking, and this was in tandem with the efforts by the Department of Transportation and Homeland Security, we could actually be the people on the front lines who could save lives. We had flight attendants who had come to us saying that they saw something that made the hair on the back of their neck stand up, something that they can't get out of their heads, haven't been able to get out of their heads for years. And had they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to approach it. We had other instances where flight attendants saw something that they didn't think was right, and they actually approached the situation, and it could have become a volatile situation where people became unsafe without understanding how to respond to these situations. So we knew that as aviation's first responders charged with the safety, health, and security of the passengers in our care, that if we were not taking on human trafficking and training flight attendants to be able to respond to that, to recognize and report it in the proper way to be able to handle this, that we were not fully doing our jobs. And in addition to that, we were hearing from members who were very concerned about this, unsettled about the fact that they didn't have the resources that they needed to be able to help people. And finally, we were very concerned that if we didn't get people the proper training with the recognition that human trafficking was on the rise in the world, and that our aircraft were going to be used more and more to traffic people, if we didn't have that training and flight attendants took it upon themselves to respond without understanding how to properly respond, that they could actually be putting themselves in harm's way or make it more difficult for the victim. So we launched this campaign for 100,000 Eyes in the Skies, and we made it known through a public campaign. We gained people to join our coalition, and they signed up on our website, and we initiated a legislative campaign. And within a year, actually a year almost to the date, Congress passed required training for flight attendants to recognize and report human trafficking in line with the Blue campaign that had been initiated by Homeland Security and overseen by CBP. So we have that now. And actually in the FAA reauthorization bill, that is expanded to train all frontline aviation workers to recognize and report so we can all be one team and stop these traffickers from using aviation as a way to move people around.
Hmm. You said one team, and one of the things that I was curious about, this is on a bit of a different subject, but is that there are a number of labor unions in commercial aviation. They all have their memberships, their groups. To what extent do the unions collaborate, work together? I mean, are they independently operating or as one big team?
So most of the unions in aviation are also affiliates of the AFL-CIO. And there is a branch of the AFL-CIO called the Transportation Trades Department. And so aviation unions are members of that organization. And we do coordinate through the Transportation Trades Department on issues, mostly legislative issues, legislative or regulatory issues. So we coordinate very much through that, through TTD. In addition to that, there are some unions that are independent unions that are not affiliated with the larger labor movement. And in those cases, typically, take, for example, the Association of Flight Attendants or the Airline Pilots Association, we do coordinate with those independent unions that represent either a handful of flight attendants or pilots so that we can all really be speaking with one voice. And that is very common in aviation, and there's a recognition that we really have to work together to address these issues of mutual concern.
Okay. Yeah, I just had no idea. Rob, I'm sure you knew all about that.
Well, what I think is interesting, too, is that for years, you know, the pilot side, you know, we'd climb the stairs, turn left, close the door, and sometimes hear what was going on in the back. But I never quite understood why companies would give the pilot. Sorry, I know I'm going to really irritate a lot of ALPA people, but why they would listen so much to the pilots and then seem to just take an ignorant view of some of what was going on in the cabin. Because I'd say, you know what? If I were running the company, the last people in the world I would want to piss off are the first line customer service people, which are the flight attendants. I mean, they can make a flight wonderful, or, you know, they could make it a little less wonderful, because people don't understand that your job is there to protect them, not just to serve them booze.
Well, you know, this really stemmed. You're hitting on a real nerve for me in the last year, especially. This really stems from the whole objectification and sexualization of flight attendants. And it's really been, you know, it started with a certain amount of misogyny that was perpetuated against the flight attendant job. And it was because of this outlook from airline management and from society in general that our union was formed. So we had to beat back incredible discriminatory practices to make this job a career. And I always say in a little bit of joking terms, but not really, that we fought really, really hard to make sure that men could have the same rights as women on the job. And and today, you know, it really is a career. And we fought hard for certification and recognition from the government for the work that we do as safety professionals, not just as serving drinks. And we have fought for all of these safety standards. Heck, we even were the first really to successfully take on big tobacco. And it was flight attendants who really made our workplaces safer by getting smoking removed from our workplace on the aircraft. So everything that we have done recognizing that we needed to stand up for ourselves. And there was a lot of, we never believed that management would ever stand up for us, that management would ever say it's not okay to objectify a flight attendant. It's not okay to think of them as a sex object, because the marketing continued to sort of allude to that, right? So when the Me Too movement broke, it was a real opportunity to finally call this out and call on upper management to take a stand and say, you know what, we're going to eradicate sexual harassment from aviation. And there were three airlines that responded to our call to stand up and make it very clear that the sexist past of the airline industry was an era that had passed, that flight attendants serve a critical role as safety professionals, and that there would be zero tolerance for disrespect of anyone at the airline. And so three airlines really responded and have worked with us ever since on that: United Airlines, Alaska Airlines, and Spirit Airlines. And the rest of the industry has really been slow to respond. But this is also an issue in the FAA reauthorization bill to bring together a task force of people who represent different areas of aviation and of victims' rights groups, and to put in place a series of guidelines that can help make sure that aviation is a safer place for everyone. And that really starts with a clear message from the CEOs of the airline industry and from leaders in government, and on down with a whole series of things that we can do to create a safer space, but then also have clear parameters about how you respond when there has been an incident of sexual harassment or sexual assault, how to respond to that, how to report it, how to keep track of it, and how to ultimately eradicate it.
Mm, well said. Yeah, very good. Very good. Well, Sarah, as we start to come to a close here, I wanted to just ask you about a subject that's on, I think, everyone's top of mind these days, the 737 MAX accidents that we've seen. Does the union have a position on how that's been handled to this point?
Well, the Association of Flight Attendants expressed concern right away after the Ethiopian crash. So now we had, you know, two incidents really almost back to back with the same characteristics. We asked the FAA for an immediate investigation and an effort to answer questions that were rising among flight crews and also among the general public. And when that didn't happen and the rest of the world started to respond and started to ground those jets, we then called for a grounding in the jets, not even so much because we were saying that we had all the facts that we needed to say that it was unsafe, but that there was a real lack of confidence growing in U.S. aviation, and that could have a lasting impact on our ability to fly around the world, on our ability to compete with the rest of the world, and on Boeing's ability to recover. So we said we really need some leadership here that mirrors what we saw in the 80s when there was the attempt to poison those Tylenol bottles and insert cyanide into those Tylenol bottles, and we saw the deaths there that occurred after that. And you had millions of bottles on the shelves. And many people would have said, just ride it out, stall. You know, the vast majority of those bottles are probably fine. And the CEO said, no, we're going to recall all those bottles because there is a return on integrity. And we have to have the public trust. And there's going to be a cost up front, but we have to show leadership here, and we have to have the confidence of the public in Tylenol. And it's still held up as the gold standard at Harvard Business School and other communications programs across the country. And we just saw that there was a real failure by Boeing to step up and understand that their reputation was at stake. And that's really concerning for us because we have a lot of confidence in the workers at Boeing who have built these amazing machines for us to fly all over the world. And they really need to be given the opportunity to make the fix here. And we think that it was a real failure of leadership that they didn't pull those airplanes down right away and say, safety is our number one. We're going to get this back to our professionals on the front lines who can figure out how to fix this and make sure that everybody has confidence flying and that we identify specifically what the pilots need to know in order to fly these jets appropriately. And finally, I just want to note that that was a real failure on Boeing's part, but I do want to commend the Airline Pilots Association and Congress and the regulators really pushing from ALPA to make sure that there are very strict training rules, to make sure that there is time in those simulators and in the cockpit learning how to fly these jets and having that under their belt. And the training requirements for pilots in the U.S. is among the best in the world. And that is a key point here as well. But if Boeing's not showing that confidence and not showing that they will address any concerns about the integrity of the aircraft and communicating that properly to pilots around the world, then we're not giving those pilots the opportunity to continue to lead the world in aviation. And so that really encapsulates our concerns about this. And finally, I would say that safety is number one. There were 346 lives lost in the last 6 months, and we have had one death in U.S. aviation in the last 10 years. And we're really concerned that Boeing put us all on the line here with some bad leadership decisions. And we just hope that there's going to be a turnaround at that company to recognize that confidence from the public, trust in their frontline workers, resources for their frontline workers to make the best planes in the world, keeping that production here in the U.S. rather than moving it to China is the best way to continue to run one of America's, great institutions and innovators in aviation. And there you go, a fulsome answer. We're really disheartened with the leadership at Boeing. We hope that they change the way that they operate. And we believe that it was the right move to ground those aircraft and that they should get back up and flying when everybody has full confidence and all the steps are taken to make sure they can get it back up in the air safely.
Hmm. I think there's a quote that was published attributed to you that goes, "Lives must come first always. But a brand is at stake as well. And that brand is not just Boeing, it's America." And I think that's very true. I think that's very well said. So Sarah Nelson, thank you so much for spending a little bit of your very precious time with Rob and I and our audience. We really appreciate it. Tell us, tell all of our listeners where they might learn more about the Association of Flight Attendants.
Sure. The Association of Flight Attendants is also affiliated with the Communications Workers of America. So our website is afacwa.org. That's Apple Frank Apple, Charlie Whiskey Apple.org. And we invite you to come see what we're up to. But I also want to say to your listeners that aviation is a magical place. And those of you who are in love with aviation, you have a home with the Association of Flight Attendants. We really love what we do, and we love that you fly with us, and we want you to know that we are always going to work very, very hard to keep you safe and comfortable when we can get to that, but safety first.
Very good. Thank you, Sarah.
Hey, thanks so much, Sarah. And I just want to check. I mean, you mentioned that we always have a home. Does that mean if my wife throws me out for some reason, I can come and live in the office in D.C.?
I'll give you EAP's number.
Thank you so much for the time this afternoon.
All right. You guys take care.
Rob, I really learned a lot about about the union and the degree to which they're involved in larger issues. So, for example, we talked about the FAA reauthorization and their activities there, and some of the other areas where the union, where Sarah herself is involved, it's much greater than I kind of expected going in. So I learned quite a lot.
Absolutely, and especially since the reauthorization, the implementation of the recommendations in the FAA's reauthorization program have not begun to be implemented yet.
We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Jeff Felmuth, we want to especially thank you for joining us and talking to us about the 737 MAX and your observations, your hands-on experience with the aircraft. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
It's been a real pleasure to be here, believe me.
And Rob Mark, boy, it's great to have you back for this episode. Hope we hear from you some more in the future.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'm just glad to have had the opportunity to interview Sarah Nelson, but also to kind of tie it together with Jeff's knowledge on that 737 as well. And this tag team thing is kind of cool. I like that, having sort of two different perspectives on many of the same issues.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to send us email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. On the website, you'll find show notes for this and every episode. We have a shortcut if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode. That's airplanegeeks.com/545. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. And we'll start with Max Trescott.
Oh, the usual place. Come on out to aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact, send me an email, click on listener question, record a question that we'll answer on the Aviation News Talk podcast.
And David Vanderhoof.
Well, you first can find me on our Slack listener team, which we talked about before, and you can join the club by asking for the secret password by sending an email to feedback. Did it again.
Yeah, other show.
By sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings talking about drones with that guy Max Flight on the UAV Digest.
And Rob Mark, how do we find you online?
Well, they'll find me usually at flyingmag.com for some backstories and, of course, online for our twice weekly e-newsletter. Or at jetwine.com, where Scott Spangler and I still hang out.
How is Scott doing these days? Is he doing
well? You know, he's getting up in years, and he's had to have a triple hearing aid replacement. If any of you have met Scott, I mean, when we stand together, it's like Mutt and Jeff. I need to stand on a chair to see him eye to eye. So I can tell you, I only get away with this kind of stuff when he's not in the room. Okay. But he will be up at Oshkosh, as will some of us, I think.
All right. And Micah, how about you?
Well, I'm also in the Slack team, which is a great place to hang out. And I urge our listeners who are really interested in the Airplane Geeks to show up there and send that email. Join up. We love to have you there. I'm also available via email at Micah, M-I-C-A-H, at airplanegeeks.com. And you can email me directly that way. And I'm on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is MaineFly, Maine like the state, M-A-I-N-E, Fly, F-L-Y, Twitter at MaineFly.
And Jeff, do you have an online presence? Do you do any social media stuff?
I'm on Twitter, at Lieutenant Colonel Jeff. You can contact me via email at felmeth@verizon.net. It's fell like you fell down the stairs and meth like in crystal meth. My brother, the doctor, came up with that and it works.
It does work, I tell you.
It does work. I'm actually in the APG Slack team.
Yes.
And but I haven't joined your guys yet. I have enough trouble keeping up with the Slack team at APG.
Yeah, I know. I try to do both. It's tough. It's tough. All right. So you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight. Also, as David says, at the UAVDigest.com. Also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. And if you want to send me an email, maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
See you soon.
Nighty night.
And thanks for listening.
David always sounds so enthusiastic.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Is this working? I just want to make sure because this computer is a little wacky.
Did somebody hear Micah? I thought I heard him before.
I thought I heard Micah Rob.
Actually, I didn't hear anybody. I think Micah has a mic problem.
Hello?
Micah, don't you miss this stuff? Come on.
Well, you know, I miss a lot of things about this, but not you, Rob.
Oh, yeah. All right. I asked for that.
Oh, well, they're getting feisty up in Maine.
Jeez. Well, they've had enough winter, right?
Yeah, it's that long winter. Have you been outside yet, Micah?
I'm planning on going out sometime in the early summer.
Yeah. Which week is that this year, anyway?
I think that goes from July 4th through August 15th. That's it.
Yeah, unless the groundhog comes up.
Right.
Is it true your doors don't even unlock until May?
They only unlock, you see, when the black flies first appear.
I see. We don't want to see his face.
Well, Rob, you don't understand this, but, you know, Colonel Jeff and Captain Jeff are, often appear together on the airline pilot guide.
I'm the good-looking one.
And Colonel Jeff is known as a good-lurking Captain Jeff.
I gotcha. We spoke about quite... I can't talk.
You're out of practice.
Can one of you guys talk for me? Okay.
Rob, what do you think? Is the media doing a sufficient job in reporting the story, or are the stories associated with this? Rob's on mute.
Rob's not there.
There he
and
comes.
That's pretty much how I feel about it. So you can take exception with me if you'd like.
I had a fun flight this weekend out to Salt City. Start this over again. Well, I had a fun flight in the Cirrus Vision jet this past weekend to Salt City. I did it again.
Yes, Salt City.
I need more sleep.
So, but let's do this.
What, you want us to slap ourselves in the face?
Slap yourself silly, Rob.